We are joined here live in the studios by Maria Tomchik, local writer and activist, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Another week without Jav. Yeah. We can do a very quick update. He appears to be bouncing back from his latest surgery finally. There was a little bit of time over the weekend where it was looking kind of dicey over last weekend.
Yeah, like I said last week, that anytime he has surgery, it's not necessarily the surgery that's the high risk feature for him. It's the risk of infection after the surgery.
So it turns out that was the issue.
Yeah,
appears to be the issue.
He did appear to have an infection going there, but they seem to have it under control now.
Yes, and he's back typing furiously on Facebook.
Awake and typing.
So making up for a lot of lost time
there. Yeah, he's not going home this week, but he's hoping for next week he'll be able to go home. We may see him next week, but my guess is it'll probably be the week after that. Or further down the road.
But he is improving, so just thought we'd share that with you. All right. In the meantime, apparently the city continues its relentless path of buildings sky high and...
Yeah, and not necessarily providing the infrastructure, the transportation infrastructure that we need to deal with
or housing. Any of the real infrastructure we need.
Yeah, you know, this week, the Seattle Department of Transportation issued the One City Center quarterly report to the City Council. One City Center was supposed to be a coordinated transportation project that was meant to identify and build improvements that would provide better access into and through downtown. And through choke points throughout the city during the period of maximum constraint. And by that I mean, and the city means that time in which the city is taking down the viaduct, doing work along Alaskan Way, moving buses out of the downtown transit tunnel and up onto Third Avenue, expanding the convention center downtown, and lots of building construction going on throughout downtown South Lake Union and neighborhoods a little further out from the core. Now, the coordination was supposed to be between several agencies, SDOT, the Seattle Department of Transportation, Metro Transit, which is run by King County, Sound Transit, which is the region-wide transportation body that governs the light rail system and the Sound Transit Express buses, and the Downtown Seattle Association. Now, in June of last year, the Seattle City Council passed a resolution requiring the Seattle Department of Transportation to issue quarterly written progress reports on at least 18 projects that are part of the One City Center near-term plan. Now, I should let people know, too, that the One City Center Advisory Group, which is the group that's supposed to oversee the One City Center project work and is supposed to lay out plans for what projects get done and what projects should be added to the plan, appears to have not held a meeting since at least the middle of last year. And even though it's held at least a dozen meetings in the past, it hasn't yet developed a long-term plan, only a short-term plan, which is what these coordinated groups are operating off of.
So maybe they need to start working on a schedule.
Maybe they need to start meeting at least hold one meeting during 2019 to look at and develop a longer-term plan, or at least a second short-term plan. Now, this week, SDOT issued the progress report for the first quarter of 2019 on those 18 projects that the City Council had identified as ones that they wanted to prioritize. Most of the 18 projects are on schedule and on budget. Some of them have been finished, but there are a couple of notable exceptions. First of all, King County Metro is at least a year behind on its plan to install 10 Orca card readers at all bus stops along 3rd Avenue, not just the ones that serve the rapid ride routes. Originally, this was supposed to be completed by March 23rd of this year. That's the deadline for when all buses were supposed to vacate the transit tunnel and run along 3rd Avenue instead. And a number of things apparently contributed to the delays, including problems with the design, submitting permit applications to the city late, and unexplained delays in the bidding process. In the meantime, Metro is employing people with hand scanners at these stops along 3rd Avenue during the evening commute. Or at least that's what they're saying that they're doing. In addition to being at least a year behind, the project is over budget by $3 million. Metro wanted to rip up and block off about half of the sidewalk on each side of the street on 3rd Avenue to install electrical cables for the card readers. The city of Seattle, however, requires that sidewalks be covered with walkable panels during below-ground work, especially in high-traffic areas downtown. This appears to be one area in which coordination between SDOT, the City of Seattle Department of Transportation, and Metro, which is run by King County, really failed. That King County, in designing the project, didn't understand what SDOT's requirements were for sidewalk work in high-traffic areas.
That's too bad there wasn't like an advisory group to oversee all
that. Now, the cost overrun will be shared between SDOT, Metro, and Sound Transit. SDOT believes that their slice will be offset by other projects that have come in under budget in the One City Center plan. Still, $3 million for 10 Orca card readers really makes you wonder what's going on there in terms of planning and purchasing, bidding and purchasing, especially since there wasn't a good explanation in this report as to what the problems were with the bidding process were.
And it's not like they're reinventing these, right?
We've got Orca card readers already in all sorts of places around the city, not just along 3rd Avenue downtown where the rapid ride buses stop, but for example, in the uptown neighborhood, there are Orca card readers where the buses stop there.
And all the light rail stations.
Yeah, all along Aurora, there are Orca card readers. Yeah. Now, the other place in which some of these projects didn't come in on budget or on time is the three bike lane projects in the report. Now, they are all currently on budget, but all three are expected to be delayed at some point. Those projects are, and these are the only bike lane projects in listed among these 18 projects, but all three of them are expected to be delayed. They are the protected bike lanes on Pike and Pine Streets from 2nd Avenue downtown up to Broadway on Capitol Hill. The construction of a protected bike lane on 4th Avenue downtown starting from Vine Street up in Belltown to run all the way down to Main Street, south of the downtown business district. And then the South End connection, that's the bike lane to connect the 2nd Avenue extension, the protected bike lane, 2nd Avenue extension, to the Dearborn protected bike lane, which runs along Dearborn from 6th Avenue South to Rainier Avenue South, a key connecting bike lane for folks who live south of downtown who want to get into downtown safely. Now, the first project in the Pike Pine Corridor is about one-third of the way. The first project, the Pike Pine Corridor bike lane, is about one-third of the way done, with lanes from 2nd to 6th Avenue completed back in 2017. But this project and the second one, the 4th Avenue bike lane, have been on hold because of, and this is a direct quote from the report, traffic complications and major construction projects in the area. That's according to SDOT's own report. But again, I want to point out that these projects were undertaken and designed to alleviate the very same traffic congestion that they're talking about there. And so putting them on hold is counterproductive. All the other projects I want to point out in the One Center City Plan are on budget and on time, except for the three bike lane projects and the Orca card readers. Now, the card readers are moving forward, but the bike lanes are stuck in limbo, all three of those projects. And that's really a function of our mayor's priorities and the fact that she is responding and SDOT is responding to complaints from people who drive in cars who just, you know, reflexively hate bikers, rather than really, I think, looking at the statistics of the increasing number of people who are bicycling as their commute option in the city of Seattle.
So the mayor is focusing on keeping the sidewalks clear of the homeless instead.
Yeah, pretty much. That's been her focus, not keeping the streets clear and safe for bicyclists as an alternative to getting in a car and driving downtown. Now, the second thing I want to talk about is an article that was published in the Seattle Times this week. And this is part, I think, of the reason why it's getting harder and harder to finish protected bike lanes in the city of Seattle. It was an article on the demographics of Seattle bike commuters. Now, the Seattle Times publishes a regular column by Gene Balk, who goes under the pseudonym the FYI Guy, that's supposed to analyze data that pertains to the city of Seattle and then relate it to political issues in the city of Seattle. It's really an article. It's really a column about statistics and kind of looking at what facts reveal about issues in Seattle and whether those issues, how they're being argued or worked on, really reflect the facts as we know them. Now, this week, Balk wrote a column entitled "Who Bikes in Seattle? Bicycling Gender Gap, One of the Biggest in the U.S." And it starts with the sentence, quote, "Are Seattle cyclists by and large just a bunch of privileged white dudes?" End quote. And goes on to speculate that if that's the case, then we're spending all this money on bike lanes for not to help people of color or poor people or women, but to help the most privileged class.
Bike bros.
Rich bike bros, yeah. So he digs into the statistics to show that in Seattle, while about 9% of white men commute by bicycle, an equal percentage of men of color commute by bike, also 9%. And that's good. It's a good thing he's doing that. Then he goes on to point out that for women of all ethnicities, that number is only 3%. And that gender difference really holds true for every large United States city surveyed. And he was looking at a survey done by Nielsen from 2016 to 2018. Fortunately, he gets it right when he speculates as to why there's a big gender difference among bicyclists. Seattle lacks a connected bike lane network, and we were just talking about that. And the safety improvements that go along with a connected bike lane network, and even with bike lanes painted on the street with no other way to divide them from traffic, that would make commuting by bike more accessible for women, safer for women, and for people of all ages. For example, kids who want to ride their bikes to school instead of be driven by mom and dad or get on the bus. But where he really falls down, where Balk really falls down in his analysis, is when he talks about income. Now, he compares the median income of Seattle bike commuters with the national median income for bike commuters. So you might say, well, what's wrong with that, Maria? That sounds to me like a good comparison.
What is wrong with that, Maria?
Well, what's wrong with that is that the cost of living in Seattle is way higher than the national average. So the Seattle median will be way higher than the national median. So what he should have done is he should have compared apples to apples, not apples to oranges. Or he could have compared apples to apples and oranges to oranges and then looked at the difference there and compared the two differences, which is what I'm going to do. So it's really simple. You compare the median income of Seattle bike commuters with the median income of all Seattle residents, and then you find a percentage difference between those two. And then you compare the oranges. You compare the national median income of bike commuters to the national median income for everyone, and you find a percentage difference. Then you compare those two percentages to see if Seattle is any different from the national, right? Does that make sense?
Sure.
Okay, so here we go. Seattle bike commuters' income is 7.8% higher than the Seattle median. For national bike commuters, their income is 6.2% higher than the national median income. So and when you compare those two differences, you see a 1.5% difference there, well within the margin of error for the survey as a whole. The Nielsen survey cites a 2 to 3% margin of error. So in essence, what we find then when we do this more reasonable comparison is that it's absolutely wrong to say that bike commuters are, and this is a direct quote from Balk's article, more affluent than bike commuters elsewhere. They're actually about the same. And given that the survey was conducted from 2016 through 2018, and the median income statistics that we have to use come from census data from 2017, then that 7.8% gap could be smaller given the way that Seattle median income and the Seattle economy has been growing year over year. It could be actually that Seattle bike commuters there's less of a difference in the median income for Seattle bike commuters than there is for the national average. So I just want to put to rest the idea that it's all rich guys on their bikes demanding that the city spend more money on bike lanes for them. That's not the case at all. In fact, the more bike lanes we build, the more women, children, and people of all ages and abilities and of all ethnicities will feel safer and want to get out and get on a bike. And this holds true for other nations that have extensively built out their bike networks, like in the Netherlands, for example, where a very high percentage of women commute by bicycle and people of all ages, much more so than anywhere in the United States. And remember, there are over 2 million people living in King County, with 730,400 of those in Seattle. And if we don't have bike lanes, that means about 44,000 to 45,000 people at a minimum living in Seattle would have to park their bikes, get in a car, and get on the road to get to work or school. 45,000 people. I don't think anybody would.
Or on public transportation.
Or public transportation. And our public transportation is already overcrowded and struggling to deal with the numbers of people who want to ride the bus currently. And, you know, I don't think we would want to take those 45,000 people and yank them off their bikes, put them in cars or on buses. I think that would be going backwards.
Just imagine how many more cops we'd have to hire to yank them off the bikes and throw them onto buses.
Right. And I think, you know, the folks who've been living in Seattle remember the days when we had a militant group of bikers who rode around the city of Seattle every Friday during the commute to protest the absolute lack of bike lanes in the city of Seattle. Do we really want to go back to that?
Well, I wouldn't mind seeing those Friday rides again, but the reason they were doing it, yeah, we don't need that.
I mean, we may, given the way the mayor has decided, you know, not just to put the city center trolley on hold, but also the bike lanes on hold, as if the two are the same. And I would argue they are absolutely not the same.
All right. Anything else on that?
Nope.
All right. Well, continuing what you started several weeks ago with talking about the different candidates in each district.
For city council, yeah. This week it's District 4. District 4, to remind folks, is Eastlake, University District, Wallingford, Laurelhurst, Sandpoint, View Ridge, Ravenna, Roosevelt, and parts of the Fremont, so the east side of the Fremont District. The southern parts of Maple Leaf and Wedgwood neighborhoods.
The district we are broadcasting from.
Yeah, where we are currently broadcasting from District 4. And this was Rob Johnson's district before he quit the city council to take a job with the National Hockey League. So let's look at who is in that district. And I'm going to, again, rank them by who has collected the most money, starting with Sean Scott. He's a Democratic Socialist, a labor activist, writer, and filmmaker, and he calls himself an advocacy journalist. He's a former staff person to Representative Pramila Jayapal. He was the former interim editor of Real Change newspaper. Now, he supports ending single-family zoning in Seattle and cites it as both environmentally destructive and a tool for racist redlining and exclusion. And he has actually done some research work, and I think he made a documentary about redlining as well. Now, he supports using the city's bonding capacity, that's loans, to build affordable housing, but he also supports setting up a land bank that would be a city-owned and run investment fund that could buy up property to develop into public housing to ensure that we're not using taxpayer money to fund private real estate developers, as we've seen with the redevelopment of Seattle Housing Authority's projects, including the Yesler Terrace redevelopment, where they sold off large chunks, and I mean really large chunks, of Yesler Terrace in order to fund a few housing units for people who make under 60% of median income. And those large chunks that they sold off were developed by private developers to house people who make 80 to 120% of median income.
Again, like we said last week, like Vulcan.
Yes, like Vulcan was one of the very first developers to buy a chunk of former Yesler Terrace.
To cash in.
Mm-hmm, to cash in on that sale of public land to private developers. Now, Scott also supports safe consumption sites for people who struggle with drug addiction. That's one of his key pieces of dealing with the homelessness crisis. And to raise money for affordable housing and transit, because he views affordable housing as one of the key ways to solve the homelessness problem, he would impose an eco tax on big polluters in the city. He would use the revenue to fund free public transit in Seattle and to build out the bike lane system as well. He would also like to use the big vacant storefront on 45th and University Way, which used to be American Apparel, and before that, Pier 1 Imports, for a 24-hour navigation center for the homeless. And he thinks it might be a really good idea to close the Ave to cars and make it a pedestrian thoroughfare, kind of like Occidental Park in Pioneer Square, which has a lot of thriving businesses that face onto Occidental Square. He thinks that this could be a good way to preserve University Way as a historic business district to allow increased foot traffic through the district and really boost those small businesses economically. He would also like to implement congestion pricing in certain areas of the city, including instituting a tax to discourage real estate speculation. And he would raise taxes on privately owned golf courses within the city limits. He would also like to work on a new employee hours tax or raise the city's B&O excise tax on large businesses. He would also like to work on introducing a municipal broadband service in Seattle to provide a lower cost alternative to Comcast and CenturyLink. I should point out that municipal broadband exists in a lot of other countries around the world. The United States, because we're so focused on capitalism and free enterprise, it's been a harder sell. But in a city that has very thriving and some very, very large high-tech companies, it seems backwards not to have municipal broadband here. Scott has raised about $75,000 with 75% of that in democracy vouchers, and he's made a small $100 contribution to his own campaign. He has a variety of donors, including a lot of folks who are giving him small amounts every month. He has pledged to not take any corporate or PAC money for his campaign. Only 32% of his donors live in District 4, but most of the rest come from surrounding districts, with a total of 40% from Districts 3, 5, and 6. Now, I'm looking at this statistic for District 4 because it has one overarching large employer in the district. That's the University of Washington, where a lot of folks work who don't necessarily live in the district, but they live in the surrounding districts, 3, 5, and 6. So I'm looking at that statistic here. So combining that 40% in his case with the 32% of donors who live in District 4 means that 72% of folks who live and work in the district support him. Only 6% of his contributors are from outside of Seattle. So the other candidates in the race can't really say, oh, you're getting lots of support from socialists around the country to run your campaign. That's really not the case in his case. Now, the second person on the list with the second highest amount of money collected is Alex Peterson. He was the legislative aide to former city council member Tim Burgess, where he spent some of his time working on the city budget. So he has city budget experience. Before that, he worked for several different banks and private real estate companies on financing for affordable housing projects. And by affordable housing, I mean the workforce housing projects that are priced to appeal to people who make between 80% and 120% of median income. Some folks would say that's not real affordable housing. Now, his employers in that case included Bank of America, Alliant Asset Management, and CBRE, which is that huge international real estate services company. He was also the editor of a North Seattle neighborhood blog called For to Explore from 2013 to 2016. And I mention that because if you go to his website or you look at his campaign materials, it is almost impossible to tell what he actually thinks about a lot of issues in the city of Seattle because he's been incredibly vague. But if you find For to Explore on the Internet Wayback Machine and read it.
And it still gets sent out actually by email. He sends it, because I get it. He sends it to me.
I think he's put it on hold, though. I think he's suspended and he's removed the archives from the active web. So you have to go to the Wayback Machine to find those archives or look through your email to find them. And they do provide some pretty clear ideas about what he thinks on a lot of city topics. So much of what I'm going to say here is based on his writings on that blog. He supports affordable housing, although his campaign website, again, doesn't suggest how to get more built. Instead, like I say, we have to rely on his blog. He's not a fan of the mandatory housing affordability upzones, and he criticized Rob Johnson's efforts to upzone the U District. He would like to collect impact fees from developers and use the money to build more schools. He would also require that developers build one-for-one replacements for any affordable housing they tear down. So far, so good. Except we understand from his background what he defines as affordable housing. It's not for people who are below 60% or below 80% median income. And he would support having the city do a displacement risk analysis before upzoning a neighborhood, which is a good idea, right? As for the homeless, Peterson thinks that, quote, data-driven policies, end quote, are the best way to reduce homelessness. So he's echoing Mayor Jenny Durkan's heavy reliance on data, even though the city can't really explain where the data comes from or give you a really good idea of whether that data is accurate or not. And just like Durkan, Peterson supports consolidating Seattle's homeless services with King County's. But unlike Durkan, he thinks the best way to finance an expansion of services for the homeless is to dig into the pension and retirement benefits for city employees, which I find to be very controversial and something that I doubt many people would support. One of his key priorities is public safety. He's bought into the false narrative that violent crime and property crimes have increased in Seattle, when in fact they haven't. And he wants to crack down on, quote, the prolific offenders, end quote, which puts him safely in the sphere of the safe Seattle folks. The sort of NIMBY neighborhood groups who think the homeless should be criminalized. He also thinks that many of the homeless have come here from outside of the state because Seattle offers such great services to the homeless. Again, another NIMBY neighborhood, let's criminalize all homeless people thing, when in fact, of course, most of the homeless are created here in King County and Washington State. And of course, Peterson wants to tackle traffic congestion, but he doesn't have any specific proposals. He was against the Sound Transit 3 expansion of light rail to the east side of Lake Washington. As for bike lanes, he was against the Move Seattle levy in part because it included too much money for bike lanes. And he's against building the City Connector streetcar downtown because it's too expensive and redundant. I would agree with him on the streetcar. I absolutely do not agree with him on the bike lanes. Now, these are his views again from his blog posts, which date back to about 2013 to 2016. Now, he might have changed his mind in the meantime, but again, we just don't know because he's been so vague about what he'd do if he were a city council member. He's a very prime candidate for some very pointed audience questions at the next District 4 candidate forum, and we'll be announcing that in the events. Now, among his many endorsements are testimonials from former city council members who knew him, Councilmember Burgess, Nick Licata, and Peter Steinbrook, and he's also won the support of current school board member Eden Mack. Peterson has raised a little over $71,000, with 35% of that in democracy vouchers, and get this, a whopping $18,609 of his own money. His biggest donors include a lot of retirees, employees of businesses that own land or are located along the Ship Canal. Tim Burgess, the former city council member who started that new PAC Rich People for Seattle, gave him the maximum. Susie Burke of the Fremont Dock Company also gave him the maximum. She's a major landowner in East Fremont. And a lot of CBRE employees, that big multinational real estate services company that he used to work for, have donated to him. Only about 45% of his contributions come from people who live in District 4. The next biggest chunk of his own is his own money, which is 26% of his contributions. And a sizable chunk of his donations comes from outside the city limits, a good 12%, double what Sean Scott's percent is. Now, the third candidate in the race is Emily Myers. She's a PhD student in pharmacology at the University of Washington. She was heavily involved with organizing graduate students and administrators during last year's strike at the University of Washington, and her activism credentials really are with labor more than anything else. She supports evidence-based policies to deal with substance abuse issues, like setting up more needle exchanges and a safe consumption site in District 4, and to make sure that there are enough low-barrier shelters with services included to help homeless folks who struggle with drug and alcohol addiction. She also supports expanding the mandatory housing affordability upzones to increase housing density and working with nonprofit groups to provide more affordable housing. She hasn't come out to say anything about upzoning the Ave, though. She wants to require developers to include childcare centers in their new buildings as a way to kickstart affordable childcare. As for transportation, she would like to fund free transit throughout the city by imposing congestion pricing to pay for it. She has the endorsement of her union, that's UAW 4121, the MLK Labor, which is formerly the King County Labor Council, and Councilmember Teresa Mosqueda. Myers has raised about $66,800 with 81% of that in democracy vouchers and a very small $63 contribution of her own money. Most of her support comes from University of Washington employees, but she also has some labor support behind her. Interestingly, just over half of her contributions, about 48%, come from people who live in District 4. About 31% come from the surrounding districts 3, 5, and 6. So that's, what, 79%, almost 80% of the support from people who live and or work in District 4, and about 8% from outside of Seattle. Like Sean Scott, she has also pledged not to take any corporate or PAC money. So a much better candidate than Peterson there, although I'm not clear that she understands all of the issues for District 4, including upzoning the Ave. Now, the fourth candidate in the race is Kathy Tuttle. She has a PhD in urban planning and design. She founded the climate groups Seattle 350 and Sustainable Wallingford, and she's the former executive director of Seattle Neighborhood Greenways. So some very strong environmental credentials there. She lives in a single-family home in Wallingford on a lot zoned for fourplexes, and that's an important point to remember when you consider what she says about upzoning. Yet she is making housing density and climate policy one of the main issues of her campaign. So she's very strong on upzoning, which I find kind of interesting. Another big issue for her is bike and pedestrian safety. She's a big advocate of protected bike lanes, safe sidewalks, and greenways because she's worked on that a lot. She also wants to expand bus rapid transit and support congestion pricing. But she's a little hazy on, I think, one of the biggest issues this year, which is how to deal with homelessness and build more affordable housing. That's really not her strong suit. She's so far received the endorsements of the 46th District Democrats and former city council members Richard Conlon and Tom Rasmussen. They were much more sort of mainstream Democrats leaning towards the more conservative side. So that shows you what kind of support she's getting. A lot of middle to upper middle class mainstream Democrats with a green tinge to them. Tuttle has raised about $41,600 with 79% of that in democracy vouchers and a $250 contribution of her own money. She's raised money from a variety of folks, a few UW employees, some Gates Foundation employees, but most are $25 to $100 donations in democracy vouchers. She has the highest percentage of District 4 contributors, with 67% or two-thirds of her contributions coming from people living in District 4 giving her their democracy vouchers, while 17% are from surrounding districts 3, 5, and 6. So she's a very strong contender, even though she's raised less money, and she seems to be pretty hazy on some of the very strong and very important issues in the city council races as a whole this year, how to deal with the homeless and what to do about affordable housing. Now, the fifth candidate is Sasha Anderson. He's the director of Big Brothers Big Sisters High School Mentoring Program. She supports the expansion of the mandatory housing affordability upzones, but not at the cost of neighborhood integrity. On transportation, she's for upgrading crosswalks and walk lights in District 4, expanding bike lanes, and working with Metro Transit to make sure bus routes don't disappear when the new light rail stations open at Northeast 45th and at Northeast 65th. So she has some understanding of the issues that are important to District 4 members. In addition, she'd like to impose congestion pricing and wants to work on a carbon tax for Seattle. She also would like to work on expanding the education levy and on mentoring programs for K through 8 kids in Seattle public schools, because she's worked quite a bit in the educational arena herself. Anderson has raised about almost $32,000, with 71% of that in democracy vouchers and a $175 donation of her own money. Her donations come from a lot of individuals, but just like Emily Myers, only about 46% of her contributions are from people who live in District 4. Another 30% comes from the surrounding districts 3, 5, and 6, while 8% comes from outside city limits. She's a long shot candidate, but I think, again, perhaps better than Alex Peterson, because she does understand the District 4 concerns. Longer shot candidates are the other five. Heidi Stuber, Joshua Newman, Ethan Hunter, and Frank Krueger have raised smaller amounts of money. And although all of them but Hunter qualify for democracy vouchers, none of them have collected any, as far as the latest report. And Beth Moncier has raised no money at all. So I've not covered what they think and their viability. I've just looked at the top five in this race.
Do the rest of them have websites that have any info for people who want to check
them? Most of them do. You can check them out. I'm guessing Beth Moncier, I didn't check hers out. She may not have a website yet. Not having any money can, in terms of campaign contributions, can limit that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not having any money really limits
a lot in that's what the democracy
society.
Yeah, that's what the democracy vouchers were meant to address. And some candidates have been much better at collecting them and hustling for those vouchers, and others have not.
All right. Well, let's move on to national and some reports out about the impact of the tariffs.
Yeah, this week there were two new reports released on the economic effects of Trump's tariffs. Now, I've mentioned in the past, too, that for people who want to understand the motivation behind the tariffs, it's important to understand that Donald Trump views the tariffs as a weapon he can use against his enemies in foreign nations, that ultimately Donald Trump is not concerned with levying tariffs and then lifting them. If he gets what he wants, lifting the tariffs is not his goal. His goal is to impose the tariffs and collect the money. And these two new reports can really point to why that is. Now, the two reports that came out this week show that Trump's tariffs could completely erase the boost his tax cuts gave to the economy last year. The reports were issued by the Tax Foundation in Washington and the Penn Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. The Federal Reserve Bank has recently estimated that the tariffs added an average $414 to the bills paid by average American households in 2018. So each household paid a little over $400 more for things like food, clothing, larger purchases like cars and electronics. In 2019, that amount is projected to be $831. So it's projected to more than double if Trump raises tariffs on all Chinese goods to 25%. His current tariffs on Chinese goods have already raised it pretty close to that. And he is talking about raising tariffs on all Chinese imports. He's raised them so far on about one third to one half of them. But of course, that doesn't take into account his latest move to raise tariffs that cross the border with Mexico, even though he has recently said that they've been suspended. We'll see. He's been known to say, as he has with China, that he wants to impose tariffs and then say, oh, no, we're not going to, and then imposes them anyway. Now, his conditions on the Mexico tariffs were to try to get Mexico to halt all immigration across its border with the U.S., and that's not going to happen. And in fact, this week, the agreement that has supposedly forestalled the tariffs makes no mention of Mexico stopping all immigration across the border. What it makes mention of is Mexico providing more economic support to the asylum seekers who are trying to cross the southern border within Mexico. That's the one major concession. Another less major concession was Mexico agreeing to deploy a few more troops to its border with Guatemala to try to keep migrants from crossing into Mexico from Guatemala, although I doubt that will have much effect. So those are the concessions that he won from Mexico in order to lift the tariffs. Now, I think once Donald Trump really reviews that and sits down with his anti-immigrant advisors, particularly Stephen Miller, he may change his mind on that pretty quickly. And we may yet see an imposition of tariffs on goods that cross the border with Mexico. Now, I want to point out, too, that it isn't just avocados that cross the border from Mexico. Much of the supply chain for U.S. manufacturing relies on parts and relies on goods that cross the border from Mexico, whether you're talking about the auto industry, the electronics industry, the clothing industry, and the agricultural industry in general. A lot of stuff crosses the border. Some of it crosses the border multiple times between the U.S. and Mexico. So imposing a tariff each time a product crosses the border or some component of a product crosses the border is going to add to the costs of U.S. consumer goods very, very quickly. Now, according to these two new reports, the increased cost of the tariffs will hit the poorest Americans the hardest. When you take into account last year's tax cut and subtract the tariffs that were imposed last year, just for 2018, the bottom 20% income rung sees a 1.1% tax cut, much smaller than what they originally saw. But the next higher 20% of Americans see a 0.3% tax increase. As you go up the ladder, you see the same thing, either a tax increase or a break even. It's only when you get to the top 5% of income earners in the U.S. that you see people who will get a tax cut of more than 1% for 2019. Once you take into account the tariffs. And again, that's not counting any of the new tariffs that may be imposed, like the one with Mexico or the additional tariffs on more Chinese goods or Trump's proposed tariff increased on foreign-made automobiles from Europe and from Japan. Now, the two studies show something else that's really important too to acknowledge, the cost to the U.S. government. The tax cut that was voted into law last year cost the federal government $230 billion, but the tariffs will bring in around $200 billion, so they almost offset each other, almost, and additional tariffs could bring in a net increase in revenue to the U.S. government. Now, this is a key incentive for Donald Trump to levy more tariffs. Tax cuts apparently did not bring in the money that Republicans said that they would when they voted to pass them. Remember that? One of the reasons they passed the tax cuts was because, oh, this will stimulate economic activity and businesses will be paying more tax, not less. Well, that was a lie. And tax cuts really never lead to increased government revenue, regardless of what the cut is. So Trump had to find a way, of course, to fill that hole. And he's doing it now with a new way to levy taxes on the American people through these tariffs. And he's free to call them a tariff, not a tax, and to say that it's these foreign governments or these foreign businesses that are paying it, which is absolutely a lie. It is not true. It is the American people who are paying it. And it is a new tax increase, not a tariff. Now, he can also, like I said, he can also use the tariffs at the same time as a weapon against his perceived foreign enemies. And I want to point out that a lot of these perceived foreign enemies are long-term allies with the United States, as a fact that the Queen of England had to remind him of this week when Trump was in England for his state visit there.
All right. Anything else on that?
Nope.
All right, then moving on to Mr. Barr.
That House Rules Committee. Now, the Democrats have been going back and forth on how do we get Attorney General William Barr and other Trump administration officials to comply with our subpoenas. On Thursday, the Democrats in the House Rules Committee proposed a new plan to authorize the House of Representatives to ask a federal court to enforce the subpoenas issued to Attorney General William Barr requesting documents in the Mueller case. Democrats had been considering voting to hold him in contempt, but that process of holding someone in the federal government in contempt, means that it would have to be, it would have to be referred to the Department of Justice for follow-up. And because Attorney General William Barr is the head of the Department of Justice, there's not going to be any action on this. So obviously that's not going to go anywhere by voting him to hold him in contempt. Instead, the Democrats want to go directly to a federal court judge to request the court enforce the subpoenas. The judge would then be able to decide on how to do that. So he could consider issuing an order for the Attorney General to surrender documents according to the subpoena. He could levy fines. He could perhaps send a bailiff to pick him up and put him in jail.
Compliance hold.
Yeah. Well, yeah, put him in a pain compliance hold. Yeah, I don't know. But it would be up to the judge then, not up to William Barr on how, on who would obviously decide that, oh, I don't have to comply, right? So the House Rules Committee is going to hold a vote on Monday on this new proposal, and then the full House could vote on it as early as Tuesday. Last month, I want to point out, too, the House Judiciary Committee had voted to recommend that the House hold Barr in contempt or do something similar to that. They, in their wording, it was to hold Barr in contempt. Now, this current resolution, again, would make it easier for that. It would not be holding Barr in contempt. It would be going directly to a court. But the current resolution would also make it easier for House committees to go straight to a federal court in the future to enforce the subpoenas that President Trump has vowed to refuse. They wouldn't need to hold a floor vote each time. So they would vote it out of committee. It wouldn't have to be voted on the floor. As long as the committee approves it and the House leadership approves of it, then it would go. They could go directly to a court. That's also included in this new proposal.
All right. House leadership seems to be a the weak part of that plan.
Yeah.
At least if we look at recent history.
Although while Nancy Pelosi and other leaders in the House have said that they don't want to pursue impeachment proceedings, they have been all for issuing subpoenas and trying to get testimony and documents from the Trump administration on the Mueller report and on Donald Trump's finances and his business's finances. The House leadership has been behind that effort. And so the way this new proposal was drafted was to take that into account and to say, okay, given that the House leadership is behind that, let's skip the House floor vote and see and create a rule so that now, as long as a committee has approved it, the committee can go directly to court to obtain that compliance from the Trump administration.
All right. Well, big news this whole week with Trump and family taking a little vacation there over in the UK.
Yeah, Donald Trump's trip to England, Ireland, and France. Donald Trump was in Europe this week with his entire family trailing behind him on a promotional campaign for his hotels and other business interests. All four of his adult children, Donald Jr., Ivanka, Eric, and Tiffany, and Ivanka's husband, Jared Kushner, took the opportunity to talk up the Trump brand. They posed for marketing photos next to landmarks, and they checked in on Donald Trump's golfing resort and hotel in Ireland. A major question here, of course, is how much taxpayer money is being spent on expensive hotels, limousines, and Secret Service details for Trump's four adult children and their two spouses. Eric's wife, Laura Trump, was also on the tour with him. While Donald Jr. and Eric don't fly on Air Force One, they've managed to turn up at every stop on the tour to take photos to post online with their dad and with major politicians from around the world and celebrities and business leaders. And of course, they're using those photos to enhance the Trump brand. Now, while Ivanka Trump, Jared Kushner, and Laura Trump all have jobs in the White House, Donald Trump Jr. and Eric Trump are supposed to only be running the family business, and they do not have any official government jobs. But they both routinely comment on their Twitter feeds about political issues that impact their father. So they do engage in political activity on his behalf, and they do bring the business into his political work as much as they possibly can. And this tour featured meetings between Trump family members and politicians and business leaders from all over the world. As I mentioned, clearly Donald Trump, I think, is trying to groom his kids for political office in addition to promoting his businesses. I think that is his ultimate goal. Now, the U.S. press did show some footage of the thousands of people who turned out to protest Donald Trump's state dinner with the Queen in London, an estimated 75,000 people in the streets of London, almost as many as the 100,000 protesters who greeted him last July on his first trip to England to meet with Theresa May. To avoid the crowds and to pretend that he didn't see them, Donald Trump flew over them in a helicopter, even for very short trips that were a few blocks around London. And that's a first for any president of the United States, taking a helicopter around the city of London in order to avoid the massive protests in the streets. Now, last year, the White House canceled a trip for Donald Trump to Dublin, Ireland, for fear of the large protests that were being planned for that. Now, this time around, they ferried him directly to his hotel and golf resort near the tiny village of Doonbeg in Ireland, in County Clare, so that he could skip seeing the thousands of people who turned out to protest his arrival in Dublin this time around. So that gives you some idea of how unpopular he is in England and in European Union and in the European Union in general. Now, just to talk a little bit about some of the things Trump did while he was over there, just before he got off the plane, Trump tweeted an insult of London Mayor Sadiq Khan, calling him a stone-cold loser. This is after Khan very matter-of-factly said that the language that Trump uses in his rallies is similar to that of the, quote, fascists of the 20th century, end quote. And he grouped him in the same class as Viktor Orban of Hungary, Matteo Salvini in Italy, Marine Le Pen in France, and Nigel Farage in the UK. And I just want to point out that he had very good reason to group Donald Trump with those people, because Donald Trump has met with Viktor Orban and Nigel Farage in the White House. And Trump met again with Farage this week to support a no-deal Brexit, which most economists have said would destroy the UK's economy. Trump has also he also endorsed Marine Le Pen as, quote unquote, the best candidate in the last presidential elections in France. He was her preferred candidate, and it's likely that he will do the same in the upcoming presidential elections in France. And although Donald Trump did not meet with Matteo Salvini in the White House, he did meet with him when he was on the campaign trail in 2016. He and Salvini posed together for a selfie that Salvini posted on Twitter. You can see that picture. It's just Google Salvini and Trump online, and you can see a picture of them standing shoulder to shoulder, holding their thumbs up together with big grins on their face. Salvini is an extreme right-wing politician in Italy who I think Trump models himself after Salvini, because Salvini is kind of the original user of social media in order to promote, including Twitter, in order to promote his favorite right-wing conspiracies and political issues. So I think Mayor Sadiq Khan was very matter-of-fact when he put him together in that group, and that Donald Trump calling Sadiq Khan a stone-cold loser was absolutely out of bounds. Now, this was also after Trump, before his state visit, called the second newest member of the royal family, Meghan Markle, nasty. This is his usual slur against women who don't kowtow to him. This is because some reporter had informed him that in 2016, when he was running for president and his pussy video was leaked, Meghan Markle referred to him as a misogynist, which I think, again, is a factual statement. But Donald Trump couldn't resist calling her nasty.
All right.
so much for his state visit being a way to warm relations with the UK and the European Union.
Oh, I think he warms relations just in a different way just than it's traditionally meant.
Yeah, I think he is trying to warm relations with certain right-wing leaders who had gains in the last European Union elections that were just about a week or two ago. They made some serious gains, a lot of the right-wing folks in different countries in the European Union elections. But this was at the same time that the Green groups in Europe also made significant gains in those elections. So we can see a real polarizing of political stances in the European Union, while the center groups lost ground big time.
Yeah, which also seems to be a worldwide trend.
That does seem to be a worldwide trend.
All right. Well, plenty of events coming up this week. Why don't we?
Yeah, so let's
touch
hit some
those.
Of those. Sunday, that's tomorrow, June 9th, is the Wear Orange Rally to End Gun Violence. The rally will be followed by a march across the I-90 bridge walk. The rally starts at 10 a.m. and the march starts at 11 a.m. That's at Sam Smith Park, which is at 1400 Martin Luther King Way South. It's right where Martin Luther King Way South meets I-90. Monday, June 10th, is the vote by the Seattle City Council to extend the Pike Place Market Historical District expansion by 6 months so that it can potentially include the Showbox Theater. That's going to be at 2 p.m. at City Council Chambers on Monday. And City Council Chambers are at 600 4th Avenue at James Street on the second floor.
So they'll be taking public comment during this final period before a City Council votes to get rid of public comment? No, wait, they're just going to ratchet it down.
They're just going to ratchet down, yeah. and make it easier to ban certain people they deem as offensive commentators.
Which is an ever-extending list.
Yeah. And now, also on Monday, June 10th, is a forum on climate optimism at Optimism Brewing Company. You can have a beer and listen to speakers discuss progress being made locally and statewide on cutting carbon emissions. That's at 7 p.m. at Optimism Brewing Company at 1158 Broadway at Union Street on Capitol Hill. Now, in this era of terrible climate change news seeming to come every other day, it's important to look on the bright side. So I thought I would mention that.
Yes,
event.
And consuming beer while you hear the bad news helps balance the whole thing.
Yeah, it does help balance it out a little bit. Now, on Tuesday, January 11th, is the District 4 City Council Candidate Forum hosted by Save the Ave, the U District Small Business Association, the Seattle Displacement Coalition, and others. That's going to be held at the University Heights Community Center from 6 to 9 p.m. on Tuesday. And that's at 50th and University Way Northeast in the University District. On Tuesday, June 11th, is the Seattle City Council public hearing on accessory dwelling units and backyard cottages. That's going to be from 5:15 p.m. to 8:15 p.m. at the City Council Chambers at 600 4th Avenue and James Street on the second floor. And that's Tuesday. On Wednesday, June 12th, is the Ballard District Council is hosting a District 6 candidates forum from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Nordic Heritage Museum at 2655 Northwest Market Street in Ballard. This event is going to be moderated by former City Council member Gene Godden. So I should point out to people that it might be a good idea to write down a couple of really good pointed questions to ask at that event, because I don't think you can necessarily count on Gene Godden to ask great questions of the District 6 candidates. That's on Wednesday. Now, on Saturday, there's a couple of events. There's a Justice for Janitors celebration with live music from 1:30 to 3 p.m. at the SEIU 6 Property Services Northwest at 3720 Airport Way South. And also next Saturday is the screening of the film Chasing Coral, which is about the loss of coral reefs around the world, and to discuss how to take action locally. That's sponsored by 350 Seattle and Meaningful Movies Project. That's from 7 to 9:30 p.m. at University Heights Community Center at 50th and University Way here in the U District. And then next Sunday, June 16th, is the Ride for Safe Streets. So meet with other bike riders at Seattle City Hall at 1 p.m. for a rally, followed by a short ride to Westlake Park to promote safer streets for cycling. That's for everyone, people of all ages and all abilities. That starts at City Hall, and you know where that address is by now, 600 4th Avenue at James Street, downtown.
All right.